Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
During his exploration of northwestern Europe, Pytheas of Massalia, the Greek explorer and geographer, landed on an island he called Iernia. From there, the Roman geographer Claudius Ptolemaeus, in his Geographia, called the island Euernia. From here, the Roman historian Tacitus took over and called the island Hibernia. This was the island that today we call Ireland. Where from the modern-day name Eire stems from, meaning the land of winter. Hello, my name is Thomas Dinas, and this is the Delicious Legacy Podcast. Welcome to another archaeogastronomical adventure. Pomponius Mela, a geographer from what is now Andalusia in southern Spain, around the year 43 AD, described the people of Ireland, a people wanting in every virtue and totally destitute of piety, and yet this country was so luxuriant in grasses that if cattle were allowed to feed too long, they would burst. Today's episode is all about the deep, rich and ancient food history of Ireland. We know Ireland as the Emerald Isle. Dense forests, expansive meadows create a unique greenery landscape. And that was the case for ancient Ireland too. Rich in grasses and waterways, people lived there for thousands of years before the Romans arrived. Today, Ireland is very, very famous across the world for Guinness, for beer, for its cheese and butter and bacon, Colcannon and potatoes, and of course, its culture influence in music and arts in general. But what do we know of the old, ancient history of Ireland and their foods and dishes and recipes? For that reason, I brought food historian extraordinaire Regina Sexton on today's episode to tell us all about the history of Ireland in detail. So let's go straight to her and hear more about Ireland. Regina Sexton, welcome to the Delicious Legacy Podcast.
Hello, Thomas, and thank you for the invite. I'm delighted to be with you.
I am more than excited because I have so many questions about Irish food history.
Good. Well, hopefully I'll be able to answer all your questions.
Brilliant. I'm sure you will. Starting off, I would like to ask you a little bit about yourself. What do you do and how did you end up in the cauldron of food history?
Okay, that's a good image. But so, as you said, my name is Regina Sexton and I'm a food and culinary historian based in University College Cork. That's down on the south of the island in Munster, an area that has a very interesting food culture background. And at the moment, I am the programme manager of the MA in Food Studies and Irish Foodways that's based in University College Cork. And I've been working in the university since 2003. I myself am from Cork, and I attended the university as an undergraduate student, and it's there I started my history studies as an undergrad. That was my degree programme. And in one of the last classes before I finished in my third year, my degree programme, I was taking a module on social history in early medieval Ireland with a very eminent scholar of the university, somebody called Professor Donnacha Cruann, who was one of the leading specialists in the early medieval period in Ireland. And I was taking a module on social history with him, and for 1 hour in one class, he spoke about food in the period. And I thought this was just extraordinary, and I was captivated. And after that, I got my degree, and I decided that it was time to see other parts of the world beyond Cork. And I went to France, and I lived in France. I lived in Paris for a year. But while I was there, I mean, it opened up my eyes to how food culture works, I suppose, in a different location outside what I was used to. So that was going on in my head. I thought that was really fascinating as an insight into human behaviour through food. But while that was going on, I was also kind of yearning to go back and study because I had missed the world of research and being a student. So I came back to Ireland after living and working in Paris, and I came back to Ireland to become a student again with Donnacha Cruann, the professor I mentioned already. And I started research work with him, looking at food in the early medieval period in Ireland. But at the same time, I was also caretaking an early modern castle east of the university in East Cork, in a little small village called Carrigtwohill. And I then started living in a castle.
How nice.
Which was another story for another podcast, perhaps. So I was kind of immersed in the past, in the present, if you like. But while I was living in East Cork at this point in time, I became friends with quite an important food family in that area called the Allens from Ballymaloe. So Ballymaloe would be known in Ireland and internationally for Ballymaloe House, which is a hotel and restaurant started by Myrtle Allen in 1964. Mm. And also more recently, it's known for the Ballymaloe Cookery School.
Yeah.
So I made friends with the Allens. And at the time, Jarina from the Ballymaloe Cookery School was writing a book called, she did The Festive Food of Ireland, but she was also working later on, a few years later on, Irish traditional cookery. So I worked with her on those two publications. And I suppose from that, my work became known to a wider audience. I continued with my studies. I was kind of had made friends with the Allens in Ballymaloe. And then I suppose kind of my work kind of started circulating kind of because people were, this was back in the, just to say that this was back in the 1990s where food history and food studies was kind of a bit odd, to say the least, in an Irish context, because it was only emerging internationally as an academic area, an academic field, kind of in its present context, only emerging at that point in time. So I suppose what I was doing was looked upon as being an oddity, a bit esoteric. And then in the context of Irish people's appreciation of their food culture, it was looked upon as being a kind of an outlier, I should say, maybe a waste of time, really, because this was because Irish people were of the opinion that Ireland had no food culture. Mm. And then it was kind of also then dismissed as, you know, that girl looking at cookery books. That's how people would have viewed it.
Right.
And this is kind of like an origin myth that you'll hear. A lot of people who are working in the field of food and culinary history will have a similar kind of origin story, that this area was dismissed by other academics because it was looked upon as being too banal, too commonplace. And maybe outside the superiority of maybe the other cognitive studies, you know. So so that's how I started, and that was back in the 90s, and I just kept going ever since.
And, brilliant.
And started looking at different areas to research in terms of Irish food in the past.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that back in the 90s, that was the perception of all academic areas, I suppose, that food studies and food history is somehow beneath everything else, more noble subjects, I suppose, throughout the world. And I think steadily it became more and more interesting, more important as people studying that part. It was also food history, food culture and social aspects of life and everyday people. And we learn more about everyday people as well by studying food history. And I think that that was very important as well. So yeah, I think it's quite big now. It starts getting into its proper place, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, when the students come in initially to look at, when they start the MA with us in UCC, we have an introductory module that looks at food studies, just what the whole field is about, and trying to, I suppose, give them an appreciation of the breadth of the field, but also to give them an understanding of how this emerged as an area of study within the academy. And it's kind of interesting, really, because I suppose food was always looked upon by the anthropologists since the, since various different studies from the 19th century onwards. But the way I suppose food was looked upon in that context and through that lens was a bit different to how we look at it now. And I think what happened, as you correctly alluded to, is that this whole looking at food became part and parcel of kind of the turn in the disciplines, particularly in the humanities and the cultural turn, in how we look at things and how we make meanings and so on from the 1970s onwards. And in that sort of, I suppose, turn or twist in the way we look at people and their relationships with one another and their relationships with the environment in general, I think food studies would have started to emerge, evolve and develop within that context. But I think in a contemporary context, then the studies have gotten stronger because we are now coming to realize, aside from the fact that, you know, you said yourself as well, that food was dismissed as being something that was looked upon as being inferior to other academic areas of pursuit and research. Food is also, I suppose, strongly associated with not cognition, maybe perhaps, but maybe more with the body and bodily functions and satiety and pleasure and all sorts of stuff, which wouldn't maybe solidify or justify its position as an academic study if you wanted to dismiss it in those contexts. But what's happening today is that we're looking at food as being fundamental to how people have good, successful lives and how they make good and positive relationships with the environment and, of course, with each other. So people, I think, are slowly coming to realize that looking at food and looking at people and their relationships with food and how they build these relationships with food are much more consequential than simply looking at food as being maybe a culinary pursuit and something maybe that is associated with, it's a gendered association with women or, if you like, chefs.
Yeah.
So it's spilling outside those very narrow parameters. And we're now saying, and we're coming to realize and probably saying to each other in various different ways, that the relationship that we do establish and grow and maintain with food has wide sweeping and deep consequences for all of us, not just in the present, but also in the future.
So in terms of Irish food history, basically, it's fair to say that people, not only in Ireland, as you said, but also abroad, we don't know much about the past food history or the rich cultural heritage of Irish food. We basically know a couple of things, probably, that you have, you have to eat bacon, cabbage, potatoes, stews, Colcannon, and that's about the general knowledge of the common people outside Ireland, I would say. Is that fair?
I think that's very fair, Thomas. And even if you ask Irish people themselves, you know, I always ask the students at the start of courses or modules, can you tell me or list out what you might think would be traditional or heritage dishes or foods for Ireland? And yeah, they do. They go through the Irish, you know, the typical Irish ones like Irish stew, bacon and cabbage, Kilcannon, Boxty, Coddle from Dublin, Drisheen from Cork. And then the output starts to slow down and they run out of things to say. So I think there is, just for a general kind of popular understanding of Irish food culture, it's very limited. It's very restricted. And again, you can count the traditional dishes or heritage dishes maybe on one hand, you know. So I think that's something that is a common reaction for Irish people. And then for the maybe the outsiders, those outside Ireland looking in, will go through a similar list like you will have, but clouding the whole issue or dominating the whole issue, I suppose, is the fact that a lot of outsiders think that Ireland is just potatoes and nothing else. So we have this kind of potato dominant through line in Irish history as applied to food culture and so on. And of course, within all of that, then you have a very negative addition to that. And that is, of course, the recognition of the huge famine in the middle of the 19th century, the Great Famine, which would have started in 1845. And that has tended to, I think, maybe cloud how people would have looked at the past from a research perspective, a popular perspective. And it has skewed, I think, an understanding of the more complex depth of food culture from the 19th century, but before that, and of course then how that's received in a present day context.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so basically we can rectify that a little bit by talking about the past. Let's start perhaps as far back as we know. When was the first inhabitants in Ireland?
Yeah, so the first inhabitants in Ireland, and of course, all of these questions will always be contentious ones. But the understanding is that you had people in Ireland from the Mesolithic period onwards for Ireland. So there's very, very little Paleolithic evidence in Ireland. Now that might change as more research is done in the area and so on. But the, I suppose we think about people inhabiting the island in the Mesolithic period. And there are a number of sites that have been excavated that will kind of give us some idea, and we can kind of piece together some idea of that diet. One famous site is from County Derry and the northern half of the country, from a site excavated actually from the Professor of Archaeology. He's now passed away, unfortunately, from UCC, Professor Peter Woodman. So that was the site of Mount Sandal in the northern half. And then another site called Ferrisher's Cove, that is to the west of where I'm talking to you from today, in the county that's adjacent to Cork, that's in County Kerry. And they give us your listeners probably know, Thomas, from your podcasts, that archaeology now isn't just going into the field and so on. It's evolved as a very in-depth scientific study of things. So what we can tell about the past now is extraordinary from not just the macro remains, if you like, the big things that you find, but also the tiny things like seeds and food residues and pollen and all sorts of stuff. So what you can piece together, and actually from human bone as well. So what you can piece together about the past from the prehistoric period is quite extraordinary now. So what we can say, I suppose, about Ireland at that point in time was that we had communities, possibly moving communities that moved maybe from one location to the next, depending on the season. Mm-hmm. And they could have been following food supply, which is really, really very interesting in terms of how you imagine these communities to be organized and their mobilities and their the construction maybe of their societies around food and what that meant for them. So what you can say in that context is really very interesting. So we might have had these mobile communities who could have been following seasonally food supplies. So you're talking about communities of fishers, hunters and gatherers.
Yeah.
So they're just as taken with the food supply from the sea and the coastline as they are from their baseline surrounding environmental areas in terms of exploiting the land resources for animals and plant foods.
So this is a period before the introduction of farming for Ireland, which comes in the Neolithic for us in Ireland. So these are our pre-farming communities. So they're, we must imagine that they're so well knowledged in what the land and the environment can produce in terms of food supplies. So it's extraordinary. So I think we need to think about these communities of people as being so skilled and so knowledgeable about their immediate and not so immediate environments and how they can exploit those for best purposes to suit themselves, you know, in a time before, you know, before refrigeration, all sorts of stuff. It's just an extraordinary thing to think about. So how do they manage resources? How do they go to places that will give them food resources? And how possibly do they manage those resources in some sort of preservation context to get them through the less bountiful months?
So
we can put that together for Ireland to some extent, you know.
Well, which is brilliant, obviously, because there's no written records for any part of the world back then. So it's quite good to have this idea. So how was the climate and the wildlife so in Ireland back then? So the island was a forested island?
Yeah, it was a forested island with a mix of deciduous and coniferous trees, probably much more heavily forested than we are today, actually. Mm-hmm. And we're an island that is marked very much with internal waterways. So a lot of internal freshwater waterways, heavily forested. And then we, of course, because we're an island with a very indented coastline, we have an extensive coastline for the exploitation of marine resources as well.
So there must have been lots of fisheries and...
So what you're talking about there is you have people looking at the land resources and they being both animals and fish. So you're talking about animals like wild boar being quite representative on the archaeological record as a food resource. You're talking about freshwater migratory fishes like salmon, trout and eels. You're talking about some plant foods that we have remains of, things maybe like wild apple, maybe wild pear, some sort of other plants, which is difficult to, because of the how they remain in the archaeological record and the identification of them. But then you're talking about quite considerable exploitation of coastline and maybe also going from the coastline to fish with boats and nets and so on, which is extraordinary. So you're talking about the taking of some fishes that they can take from boats with nets, but also the exploitation of the coastline for things like shellfish,
right?
Particularly things like limpets and young tender limpets, and maybe cooking those at the points of exploitation, like Farrisher's Cove, like I mentioned, from County Kerry and so on. There is a curious find from the later period of Farrisher's Cove of some cattle bone, which is really interesting because it could speak of this transitional period between the Mesolithic hunting, gathering, fishing, and the settling down of communities in what you might imagine a kind of an agricultural economy. So that's really interesting. And the thing about Ireland as well, I suppose, to remember is that we're this, and this is of consequence to a food culture as we go through time, is that we're a small, relatively speaking, we're a small island. We're on the furthermost points of Europe facing into the Atlantic. So people have to make the effort to come here, I suppose, you know.
Yeah.
So anything that comes here has to be with effort and intention, if you like.
Yeah.
So that if you're talking about the coming of the skills and the necessities of agriculture, they have to be brought here as well. And that effort, and it has to be looked upon as being possibly an effort with results, that people have to plan, and they have to do that for the spread of agriculture and knowledge as well as you're coming out of the Mesolithic period.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yeah, I suppose you have to say that if it's brought here and it has to be successful and made a success of it, one to use it and made a success of it. Otherwise, why bother?
Exactly. And that's really interesting, because that goes back to, you know, how cultures change and how cultures spread, and how one culture meets another culture and hybridizations and all that sort of stuff. So Ireland being an island where you, as you rightly point out, that, you know, the effort needs to be understood in the context that this will be successful. Ireland is a really interesting space or case study, I suppose, for that, for transmissions of different cultures over time. And that's, I suppose, that's something that has marked this is something that you can talk about for any culture. But if you look at it in the context of Ireland, because we'll also have another big expansion in the area of colonization later on in time. So if you look at that kind of spread of culture in the case study of Ireland, it's really interesting to see what happens with those different eras of the spread and the reception and the hybridization of different cultures in one area, I suppose. So Ireland is kind of an interesting case study in that regard, I think, anyway.
Yeah.
And what's interesting then for people who are interested in food and food historians and also who looked at food culture is that you can see how impactful food is in those contexts of the spread of culture, and what happens and what it says about people through the vehicle or through the lens or through the food window, I suppose. So that's what makes Ireland really interesting.
Yeah, and I suppose that's what we're going to focus as much as we can on this episode. Yeah,
hopefully, yes.
Yeah. Great. So we have the Mesolithic period, and we have obviously we can go through time as much as we like. But let's go back to a period that we have a few more records, let's say, and that will be obviously very early medieval Ireland. So we're thinking about after obviously the Roman conquest of Britain and the Romans left, and we have that early Christian time, and we have more records since then, right?
Yeah. So for Ireland, the historic period starts with written records, and we associate the beginnings of literacy and obviously reading and writing with the arrival of Christianity in Ireland.
Yeah.
So, as you said, Ireland is kind of different from the rest of Europe now at this point in time as well, which is really interesting because it's going to set character.
Yeah.
In that Ireland doesn't have a Roman occupation, as Britain does, our nearest neighbour, because what's happening to the Roman Empire at the time is that the decline of the Roman Empire happens at a time when you don't have, previous to that, a Roman occupation in Ireland. So we don't get that, I suppose, that change to society and all that goes with it, with the Roman presence. Now, again, as always, there's always a caveat. There is some Roman evidence for parts of Ireland, particularly down the east coast. But Ireland is different from our nearest neighbour, which is Britain, in that we don't have, you know, you have Roman Britain, we don't have a Roman Ireland, so to speak. It doesn't happen for us. Because the empire is declining and all sorts of stuff. Also, which is interesting, the older Irish name for Ireland is Hibernia, and this means a wintry place. So we could say that the Romans kind of said to themselves, sure, why would we bother extending over to this wintry place. It's not the best place to be expanding to. I don't know. So they never come here anyway in the same way that they come to the rest of Europe.
Yeah.
So what that does for Ireland is that it kind of puts a kind of a bit of a preservation order. What was before a Roman presence for the rest of Europe that survives longer in Ireland. And essentially, I suppose what we're talking about there is we're talking about the longer preservation in Irish context of an Iron Age society. And if you want, you can also kind of, you can attach on to that. Maybe you can talk about a Celtic presence in Ireland because, you know, Ireland in the Iron Age probably does see the another expansion of culture, and that's the Iron Age expansion into Ireland from its base in parts of Europe, like in Hallstatt and in Austria and parts of Germany and so on. So we see the expansion and the arrival of possibly people, but certainly the expansion of ideas in terms of the knowledge of working with this stronger, more effective and powerful metal being iron. So that happens for Ireland. And also, interestingly, what happens at that time is that we have the expansion of a language. And that is one of the legs of the Celtic language, which comes to Ireland. So we think now that we have the arrival of other people who know how to work with iron, who are speaking a different language, and maybe start to impact on the societies and the peoples that they meet in the island already to now form a different type of culture, a different type of Ireland. And interestingly as well, if you think about the Celts and how they garnered power and how they supported the expansion of their empire throughout Europe, is that maybe that they were extra skilled in working with iron, but also interestingly, they also had knowledge of and access to the power of salt and what that means for society. Mm. And of course, salt in a food context is a really effective preserving agent, be it for meat or other food products. So we tend to forget that really, that the Celts maybe were had the ability to expand and spread their influence throughout Europe and into Ireland because they had that access to salt. Salt knowledge and salt mines.
How fascinating. So that
gives, that gives you a really interesting food angle. So Ireland, probably from the Iron Age period up until about the 5th century AD, has this Iron Age, if you like, Celtic profile to itself, which the rest of Europe would have had as well, but that was interfered with or had changed because of the Roman presence.
Yeah.
So Ireland kind of skips out the Roman step. So Ireland goes from an Iron Age society to an early Christian society.
Mm-hmm.
So what we get instead of the Romans coming to Ireland is we have the arrival of Christian missionaries.
Yeah.
Who are anyway kind of following the paths that were established by the extension of the Roman Empire, you know, because they take in structure and organization, the Christian church takes that onto itself from the Romans. So now we have that sort of arrival in Ireland in the early Christian period. But instead of the Christian missionaries coming to a society that has structure and organization based on a Roman model, Ireland doesn't have that. So they're kind of going to themselves, oh, this is a different place. What are we going to do here? So they adapt differently in Ireland. So we have the emergence of a monastic style church, which has its own organization, which is different from the organization of the Roman church in other parts of the Roman Empire. So there's this kind of process of adaption, looking at what they're meeting, adapting to that and assimilating into that with best results and best purposes. And they come with, of course, these skills, this knowledge of reading and writing.
Yeah.
So reading and writing would have had its first expression in a monastic context of Ireland, in Ireland, and they're writing initially in Latin, and they're writing to satisfy the ambitions of the church. So they're writing for church purposes, for religious purposes, for canon law and all sorts of stuff. But then because they're quite canny and they want to, I suppose, get people into their belief system, is they take a very diplomatic approach to what they find in Ireland. So they adapt and they assimilate. Mm. So by the 7th or 8th centuries, they start writing in the vernacular, which in Ireland is an Irish language with its Celtic root. For us today, we look at that language as it's called Old Irish.
Yeah.
So they start writing in Old Irish and they start looking at the society around them and they start recording what they see. So this is quite extraordinary because, you know, we've spoken about the written word and all sorts of stuff and we don't have records in the prehistoric period. But in Ireland, you have this strange situation whereby you have a literate community with its first base in the church, who's looking at a prehistoric society, if you like, an Iron Age society.
Yeah.
And they're recording about that. So they're actually recording a prehistory, if you like, in a written word.
Well, this is fascinating. This is what we are we come into. So what do they find? What do we learn about the society?
So if you think about what they're doing, they're looking around at society and they decide that they'll record all of that. So they're doing their own work in Latin, right? But then now they're starting to write in the vernacular. So there's various different sort of genres that they write in. So they start recording the myths and the legends, and they start recording the lives of saints, and they start recording poetry, and they start to record the warrior sagas. So they must be hearing all of these stories and this material from like the non-monastic, you know, outside the monasteries. This is what they're hearing and they're recording it. So they're capturing this Iron Age Celtic time, if you like. So they start writing poetry, they start writing the myths and the legends, they start writing the warrior stories and the tales, they start recording the saints' lives, and there's particular hagiographies that emerge from this period, not just the lives of Patrick, St. Bridget and St. Columbkill, but there's a whole community of Irish saints that they record. And then they start writing, and this, I suppose, is where we get a lot of the information about food, is they start recording the laws of the society in a vernacular.
Yeah.
So they're commonly known in Ireland as the Brehon Laws. Collectively, I suppose, from more academic side, they're called the Corpus Iuris Hibernici, the collection or the body of Irish law. And what this is like it's the laws that are, in theory anyway, applied to an agricultural society. So they're dealing with everything. They're dealing with the laws of water mills, the laws of cats, the laws of dogs, the laws of bees, the laws of farmers, the laws of sick maintenance, which is something, it's a particular institution in Ireland. The laws of fosterage, another institution for Ireland. The laws of how farmers live with one another in an agricultural society. They record the different types of marriage, the different types of divorce. We know about polygamy and all sorts of stuff. So they have produced from different legal schools in the island. There is this extraordinary body of legal material, law tracts, that really colour the story of an early Irish society, which I suppose is mirroring or showing signs of continuity with an Iron Age past.
Extraordinary and not known at all, I suppose.
No, it's quite incredible. And the two leading, like there's lots of scholars in this regard, but the one leading one now passed away, which had been Daniel Binchy, who would have worked quite a lot on gathering the, because all of these laws were written in manuscript form. You had different legal schools. The laws are amended and they are worked on through time. So the surviving manuscripts might be from one date, but they give information and they give glosses and commentary from different eras. So there's a whole manuscript as well, a tradition to look at in terms of how you look at and interpret, analyse and understand the laws, apart from the language, because they're written in Old and Middle Irish as you go through time. But these manuscripts were distributed then as you move through time as well. They got lost, they were carried to other places and all sorts of stuff. So you have scholars who have spent their lives in tracking down these manuscripts, trying to see what different legal schools they would have emanated from, and then, of course, trying to translate and interpret these laws. So Daniel Binchy would have been one of the leading scholars in that regard. And more recently, I suppose, scholars like Fergus Kelly from the Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies, who've done extraordinary work, particularly on the everyday aspects of the laws, you know, farming, bees, cats and all sorts of stuff. So it's just an overwhelmingly rich and diverse source that gives you insight into life on an everyday level for a farming community that is remembering a Celtic and an Iron Age past in an early Christian environment for Ireland. So it's extraordinary, I have to say. It's and fantastic as well. At the same time.
Yeah, that's very exciting. So now the monks, let's say, did they write anything remarkable or something that it was interesting for them about the food customs and what the people ate in Ireland? Did they remark on anything?
Oh yeah, they do, and that's what a lot of the laws are taken up with, because essentially these laws are dealing with farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the prime function of farmers is to produce food. So we can put together quite a detailed picture as to what the diet was like. We don't have recipes now, I have to stress.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But what they're talking about is just from a purely kind of descriptive point of view, that they're talking about the main components of the diet, and then they give an indication as to the kind of the socioeconomic functions of food in that context.
Mm.
So if you look at what people are eating, the two main pillars of the diet are dairy produce and cereals. And so these are the kind of the staples of this society. So when we think about cereals for Ireland, and this will kind of mark Ireland apart as well to some extent, the cereals we're talking about mostly are things like oats, which is a grain that is probably introduced from Roman context with the Roman world. Not before. So oats grows very well in Ireland because oats, unlike wheat, doesn't really demand high sunshine.
Yeah.
And you know, Ireland isn't the best place for sunshine. So oats kind of likes Ireland. You know, it'll thrive in the environmental conditions it meets. It doesn't mind the rain. It doesn't mind the clouds. It doesn't mind the acidic soils. It will actually thrive. So that's the main cereal, followed by various different types of barley,
mm-hmm.
Some wheat, because you will get wheat to grow, but the gluten content isn't great in it. The wheat from probably the east coast of Ireland, where we have the highest sunshine, is probably better. And then as well, you have some evidence for rye. So the one that they're eating most of is oats, for both oat cakes and wet preparations, barley for some breads, but also for wet preparations and, of course, for the production of ale.
Yes.
And then wheat is isolated, and it's specifically referred to in the laws as being one of the superior grains and the breads that are used for celebratory occasions. So wheat and bread would be made for special occasions,
of course,
and it's associated with the wealthy.
Yeah.
And then they talk as well about some sort of portion of rye circulating in society as well. So from that, like, the grain of the Irish for the most part is oats.
Mm.
That's what they're eating. And this is really funny, because when you say this to some people, especially people who don't maybe live in Ireland or parts of Scotland or Wales, and you say, well, like, you know, oats was the cereal of the Irish. For a lot of Europeans, oats is kind of something that animals eat rather than humans.
Yes, yes.
So they're kind of going, oh, gosh, that's odd. So like bread for Irish people before wheat becomes more popular as a grain for bread making, the bread of the Irish is oat cakes.
Mm.
And they're funny anyway, because they're not really cakes and they're not really bread. What they are is kind of like fairly coarse crackers, or not even that, like hard tack, if you like.
Mm.
Like you get on ship's biscuits and things like that.
Okay.
And so they have no gluten. Well, they have very little gluten. They don't rise. You're not dealing with a dough. You're dealing with a paste.
Mm-hmm.
So you grind your oats, you mix it with water, a little bit of fat. It's a paste that you have to kind of push out and roll out to a circular shape or a triangular shape called a farl. And you cook that over an open fire on a griddle. And then you dry it off in front of the fire on another particular utensil that's designed and functions specifically for drying out oat cakes. So this idea of bread for Irish people in this early medieval and later medieval period is oat cakes.
Right.
And then all the various different wet preparations that you can have from oats, like porridges, gruels, adding it into other pot-based wet preparations to give it some sort of texture and thickening. So that's what you're dealing with. Barley breads, which aren't really great either. But then, of course, a lot of the barley will go for, as I said already, for the production of ale.
Ale, yeah.
but also mixed with other grains as well. So you get mixed grain ales. And then wheat is this desirable, superior food that's associated with the wealthier classes, and it's associated with times of special celebration and festivities.
But you would have lots of dairy products, cheese and butter and...
Yeah. Meat. And so here we go. And this is, I suppose, this is kind of like the story of Irish food, if you want to think about it in terms of tradition becoming heritage, continuity.
Mm.
The animal that we are most indebted to is the cow. And for me, the cow has shaped Irish culture in far-reaching ways. You know, I say to the students when they come in first, I don't know if you know or not, Thomas, but the official government logo or sign symbol for Ireland is the harp.
Yes.
Which, of course, communicates our kind of tradition with music and the arts in that respect. But my suggestion always is that the symbol for Ireland should be the cow, because we're so indebted to what the cow has done for the country. So it's given us place names, it's given us stories, legends, and of course, it's given us a food supply, and it's given us huge economic income and revenue.
Okay, somewhere here, we'll end today's episode, part one of the Irish food history, and we'll come back soon with part two, where Regina goes into more detail about medieval Ireland and onwards. If you want to hear the whole episode, please subscribe on Patreon. I've got it there, and you can be a patron from $3 a month. Plus, you get all the other episodes ad-free and with extra material and bonus episodes too. Thanks for listening. Remember, this podcast can only continue with your generous support. So please try and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, a rating, and Acast too. And share it with friends and family far and wide. Thanks for listening. I've been Thomas Dinas, and this was the Delicious Legacy Podcast. See you again next week with part two of Irish food history and much, much more. Bye.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.